Welcome to another episode of Insight is Capital. I'm Pierre Daly, and in this episode, we have two remarkable guests joining me. You know those conversations where the numbers fade into the background and what really comes through is vision, conviction, and purpose? That's kind of where we're headed today. On one side of the table is Kash Pachhutin, founder, CEO, and the driving force behind First Avenue Investment Counsel. He didn't just build the firm, he shaped it around a simple but demanding belief that true due diligence and deep understanding aren't optional, they're essential. With more than 25 years in the industry, Kash has worn the hats of advisor, portfolio manager, and strategist, eventually spinning out from Raymond James in 2008 to launch First Avenue as a full-fledged multifamily office. His work has caught the eye of outlets like Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and the Globe and Mail. But if you ask him, recognition isn't the point. Building something lasting for families navigating the complexities of wealth is. Across from him is Michael Newton, who leads wealth management at First Avenue. With three decades under his belt, Michael has earned a reputation as the kind of advisor other advisors look up to. He's built trust with families across Canada through a mix of disciplined investment and financial planning, rigorous investment management, and something rarer and endearing, authenticity. To Michael, success comes down to aligning wealth strategies, and his track record on BNN Market Call and CNBC shows he knows how to turn clarity into action. Together, Kash, Michael, and the team at First Avenue aren't just running an investment firm. They're setting a standard for what stewardship of wealth should look like across generations. Today, we get to hear how they think about opportunity, risk, and the human side of money, and we'll get their takes on this period's simultaneously exciting, disconcerting, and wonky markets.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Kash, Michael, welcome. It is terrific to have you both.
Thank you, Bex.
So to begin, I know I've already introduced you, but please take turns telling us a little bit about yourselves, your careers, what inspires you about the wealth business. What does a day in the life look like for each of you?
Thanks, Pierre, and thanks for the great introduction. I think that's probably top three best introductions I've ever had, so thank you. It's great to be here with you today. I think the investment industry in Canada is comprised of a lot of great people, a lot of great firms, and when we look at the landscape, it's really about what's missing and what do we think we can do more of and do better of. And we look really at broader markets than just Canada to see what best in class looks like when you look at the United States, when you look at Europe, when you look at Asia. What are investment management firms doing for high net worth and ultra high net worth families in those markets that we're not doing here in Canada? Being a smaller market, we often learn and adapt from what larger markets are doing. And so that's really how we approach building First Avenue. I think that combined with being in the business for a long time and experiencing it firsthand, you know, it's really the only world I know. As you mentioned, it's been 25 years now. I haven't had any other jobs or careers or been in any other industries investing. My capital and our clients' capital and working with them is really all I've done. And so I think like anything that you do for a long time, if your eyes and ears are open and you're a student of that craft, you're continually learning, and that sets up a strong platform to continue to build.
My opinion is that it's still the most exciting business, you know, or at least one of the most exciting businesses you can ever be in. You know, it's always changing. You're always learning. Even when you think you've learned something, you realize you don't know anything and things change. And it's a constant, you know, effort to keep up.
That's right. We agree. Absolutely.
It's interesting you say that because curiosity has always been probably one of the most exciting things that I have living inside of me. And, you know, I was thinking about, I use the old term called peripatetic, which means it's a philosophy of all philosophies. In other words, what I've really enjoyed about this business and its broader ecosystem is that just about anything you're doing in your life, whether it's grocery shopping, seeing a movie, traveling, reading, listening to the news, entertainment, music, in some way, it actually is either a cultural, economic impact that comes back to what happens in people's lives and in their portfolios. And I think to pay attention to what's going on in the world, it could be a fire hose of information. And I would probably argue that my ability and to surround myself with people that have the ability to synthesize it all and to decomplex things, to simplify things, is what I find most enjoyable about this business. Do I like having market-beating rates of return? Of course I do. Do I love solving a family, you know, situation from a tax perspective? Yes, I do. But it's probably that broader enjoyment that's 24 hours a day, weekends included, that gets me up pretty early in the morning.
Even, you know, from being removed from the advisory business myself for 20 years now and doing this, I think I share that with you, that nonstop interest and curiosity in what's going on in markets and you know, simplifying things, trying to provide insight to our audience of advisors, is really our, you know, our day-to-day goal. It's basically, you know, we're trying to find the intelligence and the insight to share with you and with advisors, with all advisors at large, so that they can inform their conversations as well. It's never boring, that's for sure. So what is a day in the life for each of you look like now?
I'm an early riser, which is interesting because when I was in high school, my parents used to drive me out of bed. So I find that getting a start on today has been very helpful for me. You know, whether it's 6 a.m. to about 8 a.m. when the phone is quiet, it's when I sort of get a lay of the land, what's ahead of me for the day, what's ahead of me for the week. You know, I make sure I've perused all the major news articles to the, you know, the best of my ability. But then it's just rolling up my sleeves and making sure that the clients' portfolios are in good shape, that they're safe, that the risk is being managed properly. And when times are good, that allows me more time to do the other things that I like to do, which is organize meetings, further conversations with clients on some deeper subjects that they're facing. You know, any given week, somebody has put an offer in on a cottage or is about to partnership with another joint venture at their operating company. There's always something going on with respect to the clients. And it's very, you never really know when that's going to get calendared in a particular week, but you have to be ready for it. And I'm very good at time blocking. I remember early in my career, I would take meetings at 7 a.m. Monday and 6 p.m. Sunday. And so my Sunday night roast beef dinner would be nerve-wracking because I'd have my biggest client coming in at 7 a.m. on Monday. So what I'm trying to do is really take control of that calendar and time lock into certain activities that allow me to use my time pretty efficiently. And certainly when people have asked me about this new role, head of wealth management, you know, I guess one concern might be is, are you going to, you know, what does that entail? Do you have enough time to do this? And anybody that knows me, including Cash, knows that I am extremely organized. I have a certain amount of, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder. And that allows me a lot. And I'm also very good at delegating sort of the the tasks that don't require me to do it. I've been very good at that. So time management is the big skill that I have. And that allows me to really focus, be in the room that I'm in at the time and not be thinking of something else. Cash?
Yeah, you know, I'm an early riser as well, Pierre. I try to get to bed early and wake up early. You know, our firm has two main components to it. One being a true multi-family office. And so on that side of the business, we are doing everything from providing a global view to family office clients on all of their assets. So getting a statement that shows not only the investments with us, but their entire net worth at all times, all the way to establishing an advisory board for the family and leading all of the activities of that advisory board, all the way down to things like working with families and helping them through the complexities of wealth. And so we have different concepts and modules that we unpack with families, something as simple but not easy as the difference between fair and equal. So that's one side of our business. And I find myself every day having some connection to that side of the business, helping and working with our family office team. You know, one of the things that makes this firm unique is that we have such depth of team. You know, when you look at the advisory business, historically, it's been very much predicated on one person as the superstar. And that works. The challenge is that I think there's two challenges with that. One is that you hit a ceiling. And two, clients that have 2 million, 3 million, 5 million, maybe will believe that one person could be the be-all, end-all. But if your focus is to help families with $25, $50, $100 million, they're looking for depth of team. And so, although I'm involved and I touch the family office business every day, I have to say we have an exceptional team led by Nicholas Allaham, who joined us from Deloitte. Him and I worked together for about 15 years now. But that's part of my day. And then the bigger part of my day is working with our various investment teams. And so my passion is hands-on investing. And so within the firm today, we have a public equities vertical, we have a private equity vertical, we have a real estate vertical, and we have strategic income vertical. And so the majority of my day is going from one meeting to the other as it pertains to these different investment verticals. And at any given point in time, we're assessing different components of risk and opportunity as it pertains to those asset classes. But the second part of First Avenue being unique is that we are hands-on investors, and our view is that we can better manage risk, we can better understand what we invest in if we are doing it ourselves. That does mean that we will never have 25 different investment strategies, but I would argue that although on the surface that may feel more diversified, unless you have a deep understanding of what you're investing in, there's a lot of risks that cannot be properly managed. So those are the two verticals of our firm, and I spend every day on those two sides, working with the exceptional teams that we have built over the years.
Yeah, thanks, Cash, for sharing that. I think, you know, there's something, one thing that you brought up was, you know, in order to scale like you have, you had to evolve, right? You had to evolve in your thinking, you had to evolve in your willingness to you know, bring other experts into your team who could provide that extra measure of service to those families with 20, 30, $100 million, as you mentioned. And I think you've both kind of gone through that evolution in one way or another. What was that like? I mean, because this business is very, you know, it's very egotistical for the most part, like widely. That might not apply to you as being, you know, egotistical at what you do, although there is a lot of ego involved. It's a lot of high conviction. What's the evolution been like for each of you in your careers in getting to where you are in your thinking? Like, have you evolved from being more like hedgehogs to being more like foxes? If you know, referring to the Tetlock heuristic, which is that, you know, hedgehogs know one thing, they're really good at knowing about one thing, and foxes are really good at knowing a lot of different things. Which one were you in the beginning, and did you evolve into something more over your careers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
You know, I'll do a reference that I often do, and it's the concept of staying current, challenging truths, in all aspects of this business. you know, what is gospel by some very well-known New York CFA, like led hedge fund shop, with much more media attention than everybody else, sometimes can get a lot of attention. I like to just stand up and measure those truths and adapt my business over time. It's like, you know, there's an old saying, one of my favorite bands is U2. And Bono had a few kind of bad albums. And they came out with a great album. And he said, I'm reapplying for the job of greatest rock and roll band in the world. And I think one of the things I do is I kind of in my own business meetings is I tear down the concept of my business and ask myself, you know, with my client base, can I reapply for this job? Is what I'm offering my client base on both sides, investment management, wealth management, planning, is it current? Is it alive? Is it endurable? Is it adaptable? And it's another way of me saying that, although I do believe in the traditional part of this investment world, like I do believe in public equities and I do believe in bonds, those two tenants are under pressure right now. And because of that, we've had to become very, very good at understanding alternative sources of return. You know, as Cash was saying, real estate, alternatives, and other drivers. And so that's really important to me. And if I could add in one other thing, something is afoot with what's going on with the younger generation. And when I mean the younger generation, I mean, let's say 18 to 35. I read a great article on the weekend that was saying that Vegas bookings are down. And every time Vegas bookings are down, it leads to a recession. Well, the argument in what I was reading was no, because gambling, sports gambling has become democratized. So people are doing things online and from their home. It's a different environment. So I'm not saying that leads into what Cash and I do all day, but it's a population that's a big part of our families that are looking at the world quite differently than mom and dad did. So yes, we want to adhere to great investment principles, but you have to keep learning in this business. And the minute you start learning and paying attention is the minute you're going to be in decline. So when I met Cash, he was as driven as I am and as curious as I am, staying attention to what's going on. And I think that benefits our families.
Yeah, absolutely. And to really run with what Michael is saying, and I think this is the source of one of the sources of our alignment and our partnership, and Michael being here as a partner today, is that we as a firm are very curious, and curiosity combined with humility is really the ingredient for continued progress. You mentioned earlier, Pierre, that the industry is egotistical and speaks with a lot of certainty. We agree. You know, we agree. And we don't look at that ego and that certainty as conviction. We look at it as insecurity. We look at it as limiting one's ability to grow. Often, many of the advisors that have that high degree of conviction and ego often are still living in the glory of what they did 5 or 10 years ago. And I think the industry is changing. I think to be open-minded, to have the humility to spend more time thinking about what could we do better, what could we do differently, what can we improve, as opposed to spending the majority of your time talking about all the great things you've done. That's a really important ingredient. So for us, when you look at our core values here at the firm, we're a private firm. We didn't need to create core values to check a box. We did it because we wanted, as we're talking to other individuals about joining the firm in whatever capacity that may be, we wanted to be able to present them with a very clear and framed idea of what is important to us and does that align with you. And humility is one of the most important aspects of that, because humility is essential when you think about growing. It's very difficult to grow without humility, because you're going to get blindsided. So humility, we think is paramount and essential in the pursuit of excellence. So, you know, to answer your question initially, you know, how have I changed? How have I stayed the same? I would say that I've always been someone that's had vision. I've always been someone that's looked at the bigger picture and thought about our business as a business and not just, you know, a portfolio or a book. So that part hasn't changed. And I think that a lot of the great work that we're doing today are from thoughts and actions that we put in place 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. And we hope that that's going to continue. I think it will. When I look at partners like Michael, partners like Leah Boyd, who leads the firm day to day, these are people that have these values. How I've changed is, I think I've changed in a lot of ways, but you know, what I think one of the ways I changed is realizing that you get to a certain point where you have to continue to be exceptional, but if you can make the people around you better than they are today, then the needle's actually going to move further. And so that's one sort of evolution that's taking place. And I think the other one is that realizing that not everybody at the firm has to be 18 to 20 hours a day and wanting to take over the world. You know, I think you need your core group to be very aligned, but you also need people that do a great job, but they don't need to work necessarily on the weekends and every evening. It's building a team, and the team needs different personalities, different players with different backgrounds. And so part of what makes us a great team is that we don't all think the same. We don't all come from the same backgrounds, and we don't necessarily all have the same level of ambition. And that might sound a bit controversial, but we value diversity not from checking the box, but from challenging how we would default to think. And that's where a lot of our growth has come from.
I love it. Thank you very much for sharing that. I deliberately left out the you know, how humbling this business is. And I'm glad that you filled in that space, because you know, like I brought up the fox and the hedgehog in my question, but you know, if you think about hedgehogs, you know, in terms of you know, Aesop's fables and the Tetlock heuristic, I mean, the idea behind hedgehogs is that, you know, they know one thing really well and they have very high conviction about it, and that's what drives the hedgehog. But the fox knows so many different things and also knows, you know, that they don't know everything. And you know, this business is I think you reach a stage in your career in this business where, or in your experience period, you reach a stage where you realize that the more you know, the more you realize how little you know. And the humility that's required is to come to the conclusion that, you know, I don't really know what's going to happen in the market. I know what is happening right here and now. I know how things have done in the past, but as for what the future holds, I got to make sure that I prepare for all the different outcomes that could occur, whatever the probability of those outcomes are. And that's fox thinking. You know, that's thinking in terms of likelihood and thinking in terms of you know, what's coming and preparing for it and preparing all the different sleeves of the portfolio for those eventualities. So, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on that. Before we get into talking about markets, the economy and strategy, share with us some insight into your process, your approach to multi-generational wealth. I think you've touched on it a little bit. You know, contextually, and financial management. What is your research process like? How do you use it to inform your process at First Avenue? I know, Cash, you mentioned that you meet with your four various teams during the day on a day to day basis. Talk about some of the unique kinds of work that you do with and for your clients. How do you see things? What is it really all about to you?
Certainly. So at First Avenue, we have essentially two client verticals, one being private client and one being family office. And private client, think of it as your traditional families with, let's say, $1 million to $10, $15 million of investable assets. And then family office is families that would have significantly more in the way of investable assets. How we manage money for both of those groups is the same. We take a portfolio approach. We refer to it as a pension style approach, which I'll talk about in a moment. But how we approach the planning is different. So when you look at our family office team, they come from legal background, tax background, estate planning background with some of the top firms in Toronto. To be frank, they probably could not tell you a whole lot about the stock market. And that's done by design, because I think the days of an investment manager sitting in front of you and pretending they're a tax expert and then they're an estate planning expert. Again, that may work if someone has 2 million, 3 million. If someone has 50 million, 80 million, they're going to look at you and say, wow, this is not fooling me. So that depth of team is really important. And the family office team having that experience has been a huge asset for our families, whether they're private clients or family office. For someone like Michael to be able to sit down in front of his clients and have a team of individuals, partners at the firm that come from very different backgrounds than he does, and bolt that on to 30 years of investing expertise that he has, really creates a advisory board for that family and integrates all of the different facets that are important to them. So the family office team helps families with every facet of the planning. And we have a proactive, you know, system that we take the families through. It's not, oh, you have a financial planning question and we have a team that can help you. It's proactive. It's here's what we need. And then we go through a very extensive and multifaceted exercise to understand every aspect from current tax to future tax to estate, generation one, generation two. To be frank, Pierre, that's where we find a lot of ultra high net worth families are telling us that we're distinct and different than other families. We've had two referrals in the last, I'll say, 6 weeks, both from the large accounting firms here in Canada. And one of them was a husband and wife. They're selling a business for about $250 million. Another one is an individual selling a business for about $60 million. They were both referred to three, four other firms. And we ended up at First Avenue winning the mandate on both. And I would tell you that those families would say to you that it was the extensive and multifaceted work that we can do from a planning perspective that drove them to be with our firm. So I can't sort of stress enough how unique and important the family office work is. I will also say that the term family office is unfortunately far too overused in Canada. You know, you have many that use that term, and when you look under the hood, they're essentially a stockbroker. And that's, you know, we need stockbrokers, but it's just very different than being a family office. So that part is a big part of our process and a big part of how we help families, whether it's private clients or family office, because we do such multifaceted and robust planning, ongoing planning on the family office side. What we're able to offer in the process that we take a $2 million client through is, I would say with some bias, but realistic, is unlike what really anyone else is doing here in Canada, the depth of it. So the planning part is a big part of it. On the investing side, I use the term pension style approach. And the reason for that is we have lots of experience and a great track record as it pertains to the public market side of things. But when we look at the three largest pension plans in Canada, and today they have about 70% of their assets outside of stocks and bonds, that's something that as an investor, whether you're an investor, you're an advisor, wherever you fit into investing, that's something to take note of. It's drastically different than what most investors are doing. And by no means am I suggesting that investors should sell their stocks and just spend 70% of their assets in alternatives, but it does leave room for consideration and for some lessons to be learned for all of us that are managing money for families. Because when you think about it, if your portfolio is all in stocks and bonds, when the markets are high, you feel great. When the markets are down, you're depressed. Why is it that your neighbor who has worked somewhere for 30 years and now retired doesn't worry and they tell you it's because I have a pension?
Well,
the fact is, a pension is not this magic universe that puts money in your account. It's also an investment portfolio. So why do pensioners not worry about their portfolio and the individual high net worth investor does? And a big part of that is asset allocation. And so the pension style approach and how we've built it is really to give families and individuals calculated and intelligent, methodical exposure outside of stocks and bonds. And as a firm, we don't dabble in things. We do things and only do them at an obsessive level. So when you look at our different verticals like private equity or real estate, this is how we achieve that. I will say, though, on the world of alternatives, I think that sometimes the lesser of the evils for many advisors is to just stick to stocks and bonds. And the reason for that is if the infrastructure is not there to properly due diligence and understand risk, I don't know which one is the lesser of the evils. Investing in alternatives with the view that you're more diversified but not really understand the underlying risks, or be less diversified or be stocks and bonds. But I think the ultimate is what we've aimed to build, which is having dedicated investment teams in these different asset classes, not 20 of them, but more than just stocks and bonds, and having a deep understanding of what we're investing our own capital in and alongside with our clients' capital. So I would asterisk that alternative investing and say that if it's properly done, it can be very effective, but it's not just because someone has been investing in stocks for 10, 15, 20 years, those skills do not automatically port over to the alternative space. So important to understand the nuances that are very different from private equity to public equities or real estate to public equities to do it properly.
I think it's very interesting. First of all, you know, it's enough to be an investment advisor, a portfolio manager, investment counsel. It's enough for one person or for a team of people to do just that. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on that? And then I want to ask another.
I think to give you perspective.
It's easier said than done, right? I mean, advisors all have, like, if you go to most advisors' websites, they've got an estate specialist on their website. They've got they've got all these folks that they can tap into within their organization or in some cases outside. But how often do they actually go and do that?
Yeah, so I do have a good perspective on that because of, you know, where I've worked in the past. And if you look at the long arc of what I've done in my career, I started in the early days allocating to different money managers. And I was the quarterback. I was the asset allocation expert with the help of my firm. And if you remember in the 90s, and in the early 2000s, you always would have an allocation between growth and value, for example, right? And if you didn't have half your managers with growth and the other half with value, you were not doing your clients a great service. But then try explaining to a client why for 8 years value did nothing. Keeping somebody committed to that is much more difficult in reality, right? So I retooled in 2001, 2002, to take more control of what my clients were experiencing. And the first way I did that was become a portfolio manager, to take control of that process. And I became, quite frankly, excellent at it. The numbers were there. The risk numbers were there. The clients were happy. We got through some pretty tough times in 08 and COVID. That was great. But in the latter years, the last 3 years, I worked at a great Canadian bank with very, very good support on the planning and the tax and the family office sort of mentality. By myself integrating with it is, and for a lot of people, is not as clean and perfect as you might think. It was more of an appointment by appointment relationship with those experts, as opposed to what I'm finding here now. It's outside this room is a full-time rook that's completely connected to the client's needs situation, snapshot. So as an advisor, you have to say, are you really bringing in this backup? Are you really working with these partners on a regular basis? But more importantly, is in Toronto, I can't speak for across Canada, but in Toronto, there's a couple of very good semi-national family offices that are excellent at what they do. But I find it ironic that, you know, some of my mutual clients, they have all their investments with me because they don't regard them as being the best in investment management. Conversely, I do have people that have money with other money managers, but the other money manager just pretend to have extra help in the financial planning, whatever. And one very notable firm in Toronto, I think literally last week, launched an investment counseling firm to attach to their, you know, asset management business. And they're going to do it great because they tell the people. But this was the first place at First Avenue where I saw dedicated expertise in the different silos working together, right? So I think that that was what an advisor has to start asking themselves, is what are they up against, right? And coming back to humility, I actually very publicly and very accountable with a lot of accountability, talk about the mistakes I make, right? Mistakes, I love studying the world of making mistakes. And making mistakes, you need to discuss that with your clients. You have to explain to them mistakes will happen. I'm not talking about clerical errors. I'm talking about investing mistakes, things not going the way you expected. You talked on it earlier, Pierre, about probabilities, building probabilities about scenarios. So I think being adaptable, bringing in experts around you that are permanent, not by appointment, is going to be a very, very important thing for investment management in Canada for sure.
That's a really great distinction, just to point out the by appointment versus full time on the team. And you know, I have a feeling a lot of advisors struggle with being able to provide the service of estate planning, insurance planning, financial planning, from at an expert level, with outside or third party experts to serve those needs. That makes a lot of sense.
And here, think about the continuity of your advisory team, right? You know, recently I've had some people at my former firm, you know, who's standing behind you was a big question I got asked frequently, not only on the investment management side, but, you know, what happens if you get hit by the bus story? The second, what is the plan when you turn 65, when you turn 70? You know, does the son or the daughter of a egotistical top producer, is the family going to be happy with that in person? So,
The likelihood of that, or the probability of that, is fairly low, right? It's very low.
So I think advisors today really need to ask those questions. And if you're a solo person with a team of three or six or seven, that's fine. But these are serious questions that you, as an advisor, have to ask yourself to make sure you're fortified for the next generation of this business as well. And, you know, I wouldn't want my family's money to be with a team approach with unique experts in their areas, but working together as a team.
Absolutely. Cash, I wanted to circle back to, you know, what you were discussing about pension style wealth management. You know, a lot of people talk about pension style investing, but whether or not they're able to actually go through with it is another story. It reminds me of the perennial problem that advisors have had with diversifying in the first place, with diversification of their clients' portfolios in the first place, and trying to construct portfolios at the retail level for their clients, and then having to deal on an annual basis, on an ongoing basis, with the line item discussion of those diversifiers. Especially if you look back the last decade, the last 15 years, diversification, you know, was always having to say you're sorry, right? It's always having to say you're sorry. If you diversified away from U.S. stocks the last decade, you paid for it. If you diversified into Managed futures the last decade, you paid for it dearly. You know, if you diversified into all these different, uncorrelated assets, uncorrelated strategies, or you took a multi-strategy approach, as a retail advisor, you potentially paid for it. You had to hear about the line item risk every year. It wasn't that it was a bad idea to do it. It's just that it interfered with your tracking against the S&P 500. Again, when you're dealing with high net worth and ultra high net worth clients, and you hope to deal with high net worth and ultra high net worth clients as you evolve as an advisor, the purpose of what you do isn't to hit home runs. It's to make real expected returns in a tax-efficient way and in a way that protects your clients, not just over the next 5 to 10 years, but over the next 30 or 40 or 50 years. So that's where it gets very hard at the retail level, I think, to do that kind of work. But it also makes it impossible if you're trying to attract that kind of client to your advisory. Because that client is going to look at you and say, well, you know, it sounds great what you're saying to me, like you're going to do all these things for me, but can you actually follow through on it? I don't think a lot of advisors truly appreciate how much work they have ahead of them if that's what they hope to attract in terms of business.
Well, to your point, Pierre, I think that if you're an advisor and you're thinking about the future, the fact is, and it's not like, you know, we don't write the rules or we don't say what people want, but the fact is, if you're in the business of attracting high net worth families and keeping them, you have to have a robust planning capability. And doing a financial plan that's a software that's based on 19 questions that you fill in and gives you an answer, it's not going to work. So you have there's a decision to make there. Either ignore, do what you're doing, or build it out, or join a firm that has it. Because I can tell you from the families that we're seeing, the prospects that we're seeing, the referrals that we're seeing, it's the planning and how multifaceted it is that they're saying, you know, the advisor I'm seeing is confused. They're telling me about their equity model and how great it is. If you have $50 million, $100 million, you care about return. Don't get me wrong. But what you care about is the complexities that come with having that wealth. And you're looking for the firm to not only be able to solve the problem when you've identified it and you've asked the question, but more than that, they want you to have a formal process to take them through, to not only be able to answer the questions they have, but be able to bring to their attention what questions will arise 2 years and 5 years from now and start planning for those. So the ability to have a robust, multifaceted planning, and not about retirement planning, but much deeper than that, to all the complexities that come with having wealth, to have a process that you can help take families through on a proactive basis, this is key. And I think it's always been important, but it's more important now than ever, just based on demographics. You have more and more people that are 55, 60, 65, 70 than ever. And yes, they know 9% is better than 8, and they know 8 is better than 7. But they're worrying about things like, I have a cottage that's worth X amount of dollars, and my son doesn't want to go there because he doesn't talk to my son-in-law. And so when I pass, that's half my daughter and half my son, but my son doesn't use it. What do I do? And if I keep it, then my daughter has to pay for all of the maintenance, and I don't know if she's going to want to do that. And if she does that, then I got to find a way to equalize them. How do I approach all of these things? Right. So that's one concept. There's probably 20 of them. And if you're an advisor that's still thinking you're going to get the portfolio update and say how you did better than the market, I can tell you that that client's at risk. And you're going to lose that client to a firm that can help them with those kinds of things. So I think having a robust planning ability
Having a robust planning capability is going to be very important to the future, just based on demographics. And as Michael said it, and as you said it, most firms have great financial advisors and have great tax and estate planning people. But that's not where the deficiency is. The deficiency is there's no formal process of what a family goes through to solve those problems. Those people are parachuted in when there's often need. And the families themselves don't know what questions to ask. So the work ends up often not happening, or if it does, it's more event-driven as opposed to fully integrated at all times. So I think that's one area. I think the other area is, if you're an advisor, you know that alternatives are not going away. And so you got to ask yourself, how do I want to give my clients exposure to this space? Do I want to pick a few managers and stick with them? Do I want to, you know, be in this type of alternative or not the other? Or do I want to do a fund of funds? There's a lot of different ways to do it. What we find is having the expertise within the firm. I mean, imagine you're an advisor and you bring your clients in and you go sit with our real estate team. We have about 25 full-time professionals just in our real estate business. And they come from firms like Brookfield. Two of our partners are from Brookfield, from Mintropia, top real estate firms. Those 25 people cannot tell you a single thing about stock market, but they don't need to, right? And so having that expertise is going to become increasingly important to be able to really be able to convey to your client that you understand what they're investing in. And not necessarily you understand every nuance of it, but there's a team there and you interact with them every day. It's very different than a wholesaler coming to see you, giving you a two-page summary about how private assets are doing. I would argue that you're not going deep enough and doing your responsibility, delivering on your responsibility to really understand what you're investing in. So I think there's these two concepts, and advisors have to decide. I mean, they don't have to do anything, but they probably want to think about how do they want to tackle those moving forward to have a firm or an offering that's relevant. The planning, you know, is really important. The alternatives are also important. And what we are really sort of proud about here is that we've built distinction through the depth of team we have in those two verticals. And so we believe it's going to be a strong platform to grow. And it's going to be a strong platform for select advisors to be a part of.
It's fascinating to hear it from you both firsthand, because you're both former advisors. And for an advisor who's actually, you know, looking to scale into the higher echelon of asset management, of wealth management and family, you know, family wealth, it's a great conversation we're having, because it really provides a realistic picture. You know, if you hope to be in, if down the road, if 5 years from now, you hope to be the advisor and advisor that high net worth and ultra high net worth clients seek, you know, potentially your advice, you do have to do your homework, and you do have to do the groundwork, and you do have to, you know, build your network of your own exclusive network of professionals, whether you know, and how you go about doing that is going to matter as well. I'm guessing, you know, the way you've gone about doing it isn't the only way to do it. It's the way you've done it. But it's definitely part of that process of scaling up to possibly having less clients, but significantly larger clients. And, you know, it's great. It's wonderful to hear it from your perspective, because you've been there and you've done that. To put it simply, been there, done that.
But still doing it. Yeah.
Always. It's still evolving, still looking at how you can make everything you do better. What kind of conversations are you having with clients these days? What kind of concerns are clients expressing? I know Cashy mentioned, you know, event-driven things, situations that clients find themselves trying to solve. What are the conversations you're having with clients maybe in the context of this year, the year that it's been, you know, with all the turmoil in the market, what kind of concerns are clients calling you up about in that context?
Well, it's still, you know, Trump front and center. And it's interesting how people fall on both sides of the aisle on that. Right. I saw a recent poll where it said, what's the economy look like in the next 12 months? And Republicans say 70% great and Democrats say 11%, you know, great. So it's quite a divisive period right now on the political front. And then the geopolitical situation, obviously, there's five global confrontations in one way or another happening right now. We have the idea of the large mega seven concentration risk. U.S. exceptionalism, how long can it continue for? And those are, you know, those are investment related, capital related worries. But needless to say, as we just mentioned, you know, we have a great diversification benefit with what we're trying to do with assets. So that helps immensely. But on the public equity side, the markets have become very popular. They've become entertainment again. And you do have to take advantage of that trend to some degree in your portfolios. And there's a certain amount of disbelief that you might have to have when it comes to some of those public equities. But understanding what will happen when things turn, which they inevitably will, is the, you know, in case of emergency break glass, is something that this firm is going to make sure our clients are going to be okay when that happens, if they're not okay already. So that would be it. And, you know, certainly going through April with Trump was probably one of the more trying periods for a lot of people. I was fortunate enough to read a book called Robert Greene's 48 Laws of Power, that basically I had been told was Trump's playbook. And one of his 48 Laws of Power is keep people in a state of disbelief and terror. And Trump's pretty good at that. That's part of his negotiating tactic. So trying to understand from that perspective how it might impact you was valuable to me. Can't speak for cash, but I found it quite helpful during that April period.
Do you feel has the concern that among clients dissipated about the tariffs, about the threat to Canada, to the Canadian economy, does that feel like it has diminished at all? Are there new concerns clients are expressing today? Are they worried about concentration risk in the market?
Well, I mean, one thing I would say, surprisingly, is some clients are very comfortable with what we're doing. So they actually, there is a high volume of call coming in, believe it or not. There's a sense of relaxation. There is a sense of relaxation, but, you know.
That comes from being prepared, right, Mike? I mean.
Being prepared. You know, what's funny is one blind side that I have is I think that my clients have read everything, all the nine major newspapers every morning. And I always find that some of them, all they do is read the sports section. So you just have to. I will say that more personal questions, I think, were dominant as well. For example, on the interest rate front. You know, anybody that has mortgages, they're wondering where things stand on that respect. What's credit like? You know, I often get the question as I'm heading down to the States for 6 months or was heading to Europe, where do you think of the dollar here? But I mean, just questions like that, more personal in nature.
I echo what Michael's saying, Pierre. I think one of the things that we've done over the years is help clients separate how they feel and how they invest. And the reality of it is more is not better. And what I mean by that is for clients to watch the business news all day and read the papers is not going to make you be a better investor necessarily. Trying to predict what Trump will do or will not do will not make you a better investor necessarily. These are factors that have so many moving parts to them that the probability of being accurate trying to pick a direction is very low. I think that the where there is material benefit is going deep on what you are investing in, whether it's stock, private equity, real estate, having an obsessive level of commitment and understanding to what am I investing in? How does this business operate? That is going to be a bigger mover. So to Michael's point, we don't really, you know, we're not getting clients calling with what's going to, you know, what do you think about this that Trump's doing or that thing? But part of that is we've conditioned clients to understand that that's not a winning mindset. You know, whether you like Trump, love Trump, or dislike Trump, you know, that's fine. And we could talk about that, but that's not going, you know, that how you feel in that front should not have a high correlation to how you invest, because it's not really reflective of risk and opportunity. You know, I think the thing that not many people are talking about that they should is when you look at the stock market, let's say the S&P 500, last 50 years, it's gone up by about, give or take, 8% a year. While the last few years, it's gone up by more than double that. So there will be a point where we have a reversion of the mean. And for investors that are in predominantly just stocks and bonds, that's going to be painful. And so, you know, the idea of having that pension style approach is always important, but it's going to be absolutely very important to rebalance into that or have exposure to these other asset classes before that happens. And historically, if an advisor does not have access to a pension style approach, you're selling stocks and building cash, and that can work. You know, Michael's done it very well in the past, but I think he'll be the first one to tell you that it's tough. It's tough to get that right. And when you get it wrong, you're on the sidelines and the market's going higher. So the ability to not be in stocks, but be in other asset classes that are appreciating instead of in cash, where it's a binary call, increases your probability of blending to better returns. But again, we will not have 18 to 20% return years on an ongoing perpetual basis. Any advisors will tell you exactly which day that's going to end. I'm going to tell you, I have no idea. But what I do know is that there will be a reversion of the mean, and owning assets like private equity and strategic income and exposure to real estate will help balance that out.
Yeah. I mean, the last 3 years have been a totally anomalous performance, but also completely the opposite of what people expected.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, So you know, you're dealing with both, and the, you know, the odds of making a consecutive series of decisions about, you know, how much risk to take or not to take, or how much cash to have or stocks to have in your portfolio on an ongoing basis, that's like trying to win, you know, the brackets in March Madness, right? You know, it's about as likely as that.
Yeah,
I would agree.
Well, and everyone likes to talk about at the cocktail party, the big return that they had. You know, if I had 28%, 52%, 19%. But the reality of it is, when you look at a longer period of time, investors are blending somewhere between sort of 6 and 9%. I mean, that's when you know, in a stock portfolio, stocks and bonds. So really it gets back to saying, okay, so if you know you're going to get a 6 to 9% and a fee somewhere in there, why don't we pursue that 6 to 9% with much lower volatility, with much less highs being as high as they are, lows being low as they are, and let you focus on the other parts of your life. So you're not feeling, you know, really, really good in those great years and really, really bad in the bad years, and still blends to something that's the same, if not even better, with a fraction of the volatility. And that's really what the pension style approach is about. Because if this year's return was what investors would sustain over the long term, I get it. I would say it's worth the volatility. But, you know, to blend to 20% a year, yes, some people do it over 3 years, 5 years. But show me someone that's done it over the last 20 years. It's near impossible. And so again, every advisor will talk about that year and three quarters that they have, you know, the nominal outperformance of. But again, if we're looking over the long term, and a long term to me isn't even 3 or 5 years, if you look at over 10 years, you're going to get realistically somewhere to 6 to 9%, maybe 6 to 10% net of fees. So again, it's, can we do that with less risk, less excitement, so you can focus on the other aspects of your life that are important to you?
when you're speaking to your advisor clients, what kind of conversations are they having with you? Are they having conversations about diversification or risk mitigation, or what kind of topics are coming up with advisors?
As a firm as a whole, we have very little to no advisors, let's say investment advisors, okay, helping their money with us, because, you know, they probably have their money with themselves. If they don't, then maybe they're in the wrong business. But but maybe if you think about institutional clients or lawyers or accounts professionals, maybe you just take it a little bit broader. I would say that humans continue to be humans. What I mean by that is the biases kick in both ways, good and bad. So look, 2 years ago, you couldn't give people enough exposure to real estate. And today it's, well, did you read this Globe and Mail article? And the reality of it is neither approach is correct. And having a pension style approach doesn't overweight real estate when the investor wants it. And it's going back to what I was saying, getting away from how you feel and how you invest. And then the fact that the Globe and Mail today may write an article that has to do with one segment of the real estate market and not necessarily the segment that they're invested in, that also is not, enough to stay away from it. So being disciplined, has always been important, has always made sense. It continues to make sense. I think whatever the hot asset class is, people wish they had all of their money in that. But I would also say that our clients have really learned and grown with us over the years to not be like that. They understand that the pension style approach isn't about picking what the hot sector or asset class it's going to be. It's really about the pursuit of that 6-9% return, depending on their asset base, with the least level of volatility, with the highest degree of consistency, with the highest degree of diversification. These are some of the factors that they're looking for. So again, I think that you have investors that still believe they can get a 20% long-term per year return. But I think as investors become more informed, more experienced, they realize that, the best case scenario, you're getting sort of a high single digit per year return. And then it becomes about, how can I achieve that return with the lowest headaches, with the lowest risk, and with the greatest consistency? And that's where the pension style approach again becomes distinctive compared to a traditional stock and bond portfolio.
Yeah, I have a feeling that a lot of conversations advisors have with clients are of their own making. Like if they're not good conversations, or if they're common conversations, like, oh, my account isn't doing as well as the S&P 500, or one of my friends at a cocktail party told me about this, that, and the other, how they've been investing in Bitcoin for the last 5 years or 10 years. Why didn't you ever talk to me about that? In a way, sometimes, because advisors are taking on all, the role of stock picking, for example, or investment picking in general.
Or the role of God.
Well, if you want to go as far as that.
But the role of stock picking is just when you claim to know everything that's going to happen, right? And you put yourself out there as you're going to know, what Trump's going to do. Then your clients are going to ask you, what's Trump going to do?
Right. But as you exactly. So you're having poor conversations because the basis for that conversation has been set by you.
Yeah,
if you're having those kinds of conversations, is because you've invited it. Cash, Mike, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight. It's been terrific talking to you and meeting you and catching up with you.
You're most welcome.
That was great. Hopefully we'll do it again.
I would love to have a follow-up conversation with you both.
Great. All right, Vera. Thank you.